It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a look at last night's Grammy Awards. We want to hear what you thought.
First, immigration agents made over 600 arrests in at least 11 states over the last week. According to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, the efforts were routine and no different from the arrests of undocumented immigrants that took place under President Obama.
But reports say there's a heightened sense of fear in immigrant communities around the country. Protests have also broken out across the country in opposition to the detention of immigrants and President Trump's executive orders. In Milwaukee, advocacy groups have organized a protest today called A Day Without Latinos, Immigrants, and Refugees. Protesters marched to the Milwaukee courthouse, and many of the marchers told the Journal Sentinel that they feared deportation in the current political climate.
Alan Gomez joins us now. He's an immigration reporter for USA Today. Alan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the big question I think people are wondering about is this something new and different, these recent arrests, or is this a continuation of policies we've been seeing for the last 8 years?
Well, when you look at the total numbers of people that were arrested, and this is information that's been provided by ICE over the last couple of days, it seems that they arrested about 655 people in these raids throughout the country last week. And of those, something like 94% would fall into what President Obama referred to as his enforcement priorities. So that's people with extensive criminal records, people that pose some kind of national security threat, have gang ties, or have recently crossed the border. I did a quick accounting of the numbers that they put out, and of those 655, about 48 of them would not have fallen under those priorities. And I can tell you from having covered a lot of these raids over the years, those numbers seem to reflect a lot of what happened under the Obama administration. They do two or three of these raids a year. Just about this time last year, the Obama administration did a raid specifically targeting women and children from Central America, a very controversial raid at the time. But when you look at it in that context, it does seem like these were regular raids that they have conducted. The ICE director in L.A., said that they'd been planning this even before Trump signed his executive order on January 25th. But I think the concern is that President Trump has also vastly expanded the pool of people who he considers priorities. So what you have is a community on edge kind of waiting for that to start. So as soon as they hear raids, of course they're going to think that this is it. It's starting. But again, the numbers that we're looking at so far, it looks like so far that this is just kind of regular run-of-the-mill for ICE.
Do we have any indication that Immigration and Customs Enforcement is going to be changing its tactics, its own priorities, based on what they've heard so far from President Trump?
And that's what we're all watching for very closely. I mean, on the one hand, we have Secretary John Kelly, he's the new Department of Homeland Security Secretary, put in by President Trump. And just today, in a statement that he put out, he made very clear that they are going to continue their focus on those who pose a threat to public safety, have been charged with criminal offenses, and have committed other immigration violations or have recently reentered the country. That pretty much summarizes what President Obama's deportation priorities were, or the people that they would target. But at the same time, what we're wondering about are the less publicized ones, the ones that aren't in these big raids, that they're not putting out numbers on. And so what we saw a case in Arizona recently where a woman had been regularly checking in with ICE for years, she checks in after Trump is inaugurated, and boom, she's deported. So those are the kind of cases that I think we're all going to be watching for to see if this is all kind of PR, that, hey, we're just going to be going after the criminals, or if in reality they're going to be going underneath and really trying to get a lot of these people who don't have criminal records and aren't that much of a threat.
We'd been hearing from President Trump, then-candidate Trump, all along saying he wanted more enforcement officers, whether that meant hiring new people to do that enforcement or reshuffling the jobs within the Customs Department to bring more people out there doing these kind of arrests and deportations. Have we seen any kind of steps toward that?
Haven't seen any so far. That's absolutely not to say that they're not coming, but so far I can tell you I think the Department of Homeland Security has for the most part been focused on the travel ban for people coming from those seven majority Muslim countries that has been now blocked by the federal courts. And I can tell you that the sort of senior administration of The Department of Homeland Security has been consumed by that and trying to figure out how to challenge it in court, whether they need to write a new order. So this is, to some degree, I think, kind of, you know, the idea of deporting people already in the country is not exactly the very top of their list. But very quickly, they could change that because President Trump, yes, he needs more money from Congress to hire more ICE agents, but this is a very big agency. There's about 14,000 ICE agents, and only about 7-8% of them are tasked with actually going out and finding undocumented immigrants in the country. They're doing a wide variety of other things, and Trump could quickly retask a lot of them to go out into the country and do these things. We haven't seen that it's happened just yet, but obviously that's what we're watching for very closely.
Talking to Alan Gomez from USA Today, looking at recent immigration and custom enforcement arrests and deportations over the last week and the reaction to that. Alan, what are we hearing from advocacy groups? We've talked about this before this election even. Some immigration advocates had referred already to President Obama as deporter-in-chief. One year we saw over, 400,000 deportations under President Obama. Are immigration advocates particularly worried at this point about President Trump doing more than President Obama had done?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is the kind of thing where, you know, I think there was a period between the election and the inauguration where we heard a lot of people saying things like, oh, he's not going to go as far as he said on the campaign. That was just talk. But as we're seeing in this first few weeks of his administration is that he's definitely going after everything or a good chunk of what he promised he would do. So I think they're rightfully nervous to expect him to want to ramp up deportations to really increase the number of people that are leaving this country. Because understand, under President Obama, yeah, he reached the peak of 400,000 now several years ago. But in the last 3 years of his administration, those numbers really plummeted. So the last year of his administration, they only deported about 230-some thousand people from the country. And so I think what any of these immigration advocacy groups with any undocumented immigrant living in the country is looking at is a president who, from day one of his candidacy, said that this was going to be a priority of his, and there's no reason to think that he's not going to. The order that he signed on January 25th was very clear in expanding the pool of people who he would target for deportation. So I think they're absolutely right to assume that it's coming. We just haven't seen it just yet.
I want to talk about the state of immigration in the United States. First of all, from Mexico, what are the current numbers when it comes to people coming in from Mexico and people going back to Mexico?
Right now, it's pretty much flat. You know, the rise in the undocumented immigrant population in this country peaked throughout the 90s and the early 2000s. It was just just a flooding across into the United States from Mexico. Then when our economy crashed, then that's when things stopped and people stopped coming over here from Mexico. And last year was the first that the Pew Research Center estimated that as many people were leaving the United States and going back to Mexico as were coming in. The economy in Mexico has improved, so they have more job opportunities there. And just with the gradual increase in immigration enforcement in the United States, it's become harder and harder to get into the country and to stay here. And so what we have is this very flatlined level of immigration, illegal immigration coming from Mexico. We have seen some increases in other areas, for example, from Central America. So there's a lot of people coming from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador as those countries grapple with just raging violence down there. But at least that the Mexican immigration, which is by far the biggest chunk of it, it has been flat now for several years.
I wanted to ask you about Central America because we've talked to you in the past about your trip down there, looking at the sources. The hotspots, if you will, of immigration for Central America. That hasn't been front and center in the headlines lately. What are we seeing when it comes to trends of people coming up here undocumented from Central America?
They're still coming. And this is one of these things. When you cover immigration for a long time, it's interesting to see when these stories kind of become national headlines. When they become sort of common knowledge. You know, right now it's the violence down there is still raging. Especially Honduras and El Salvador rank among the top five in the world when it comes to homicide rates. Gang violence there is terrible. Government corruption is a very big problem. A lot of people who just really think that they cannot that their children cannot lead safe lives, and so they try to ship them out and they get them out of here. And so those numbers have continued going, especially now that Trump is coming in. A lot of them said, hey, we better get in now before he takes office and really, you know, either builds his wall or really ramps up deportations along the border. And so we're still seeing those numbers coming across from those three countries, without a doubt. President Trump, in his executive order, did a couple of other things that would really target that. He's trying to end something called catch and release, where people who were caught along the border, they go through a court hearing, but then they're released into the United States and told, hey, come back for the rest of your court hearings. And many of them obviously don't show up and just blend into the country and aren't seen again by immigration enforcement. But once they start making those kind of changes, if they add more immigration judges and the speed with which we can deport people increases, I think that's when you might start seeing some of those numbers go down. But as of right now, it's still definitely a good number of people coming from those countries.
You mentioned the number of immigration judges. I've seen former Homeland Security officials saying this is one of our big problems, this backlog in the courts that deal with the border and with undocumented immigrants. How big a shortfall do we have there?
Oh, it's and I'm going to apologize, Rob. It's that I don't have the numbers right in front of me. It's been a little while because we've been chasing so many immigration stories
the
last few weeks. But what I can tell you, it's we're at least down a couple of hundred from what Congress has approved. So there is theoretically funding there to hire a lot more judges and judge teams to go down there because the backlog right now, basically, if you are ordered, if you go into an immigration proceeding, it could be a couple of years before you get a hearing, and then once you go through your appeals and everything like that, it could be a very long time before you get deported. So even if you hired a lot of judges, it would still take years to go through the backlog and to really get us up to speed on those cases. And that's why it's important. Another aspect of his January 25th order would be to expand the idea of something called expedited removal. And these are cases where people are caught along the border, especially, or caught within, I think it's about 100 miles of the border, and they don't even have to see a judge to be deported. Border Patrol agents and other people who have been sort of trained and given that power can sort of make the determination on their own and order somebody deported. And so that's one way to get around the fact that we're short so many judges. Again, I think that's one of the many, many stories just that we haven't been able to get to and spend enough time on to really examine because of all the other immigration executive orders and all the other things going on. But that's something that we should all definitely be paying close attention to, because once you take that power from a judge and hand it over to a law enforcement officer, that just raises all sorts of questions about their due process rights and about how they're being treated, whether their refugee claims are being processed correctly, whether their asylum claims are being processed accurately. And so that's something that we're going to be, again, watching very closely in the weeks and months to come.
Well, Alan, I'll let you get back to your reporting on that.
Thank you very much, Rob.
Thanks a lot. That's Alan Gomez. He's an immigration reporter for USA Today. He joined us to talk about the arrests of immigrants around the country over the last week. Right now, big performances, drama, tributes, some technical difficulties, and a bit of politics along the way. It was all part of last night's Grammy Awards ceremony.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you watch? Was there a performance you loved or perhaps hated? Did they get the awards right? Do you think Beyonce should have beaten Adele in some of the big categories? Call in 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post about the Grammys on the Central Time Facebook page.
Yeah, and I'm really curious. I wonder if people watch the Grammy Awards that much anymore. My kids watched. Mm-hmm. I watched on and off. Did you watch?
I did not watch. No.
That's one of my big questions to listeners. Are Grammys must-see TV for you? Did you watch them just because you had nothing better to do, or do you actively like it? Is it the performances, the clothes, the hopes of a mishap? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll check in on a couple of the big minutes there. We heard from Eddie on Facebook already. Eddie writes that Lady Gaga's outfit last night on the red carpet was designed, I didn't know about this, by Alex Ulickney, who lives here in Wisconsin.
Huh.
We'll have to check that out a little more. Eddie posted a picture of the outfit on the Facebook page. It's probably safe for work. It's kind of on the borderline, but I'll have to check in on this the fashion designer who designed that.
And let's hear a bit of music, because when I do tune in for the Grammys, I listen for music. And some of the moments that got a little of it got some attention as part of a tribute to the late George Michael.
Yeah,
Adele.
We don't have the music on this here, I'll say. We have sort of the between the music. Adele started this tribute to George Michael. It was a bit off key, so let's listen to her.
I'm sorry for swearing, and I'm sorry for starting again. Can we please start it again? I'm sorry, I can't mess this up for him. I'm sorry, I can't. I'm sorry for swearing, I'm really sorry.
The swearing was bleeped on the TV, but a scary moment for a performer in front of millions of people. As a, you know, somebody performs on a small scale, I've been unable to hear myself and been off key before.
But she has a history with this.
But I'm in front of an audience of maybe high single digits. She's on, you know, in front of millions of people here. So that's awkward. So she stopped, restarted, did better.
Uh-huh.
Not great.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of a weird rendition of a George Michael song, too.
And then, so we hear, you know, Adele, the big winner, of course, album, record, and song of the year. But in her album acceptance speech, she didn't think it was the right call.
Here's a listen.
I can't possibly accept this award, and I'm very humbled, and I'm very grateful and gracious, but my artist of my life is Beyonce, and this album for me, the Lemonade album, was just so monumental, Beyonce. It was so monumental, and so well thought out, and so beautiful and soul-bearing, and we all got to see another side to you that you don't always let us see, and we appreciate that, and all us artists here. Adore you. You are our light.
Not an audio difficulty, but a bleep there, I believe. And let us know if you have thoughts on that at 800-642-1234. Should Adele have lost to Beyonce as Adele thought she should? 800-642-1234. Share your favorite Grammy moments, live performances that you liked. And are you into any of the high-profile albums that showed up there? Lemonade by Beyonce, 25 mm-hmm. by Adele, the Black Star album by David Bowie.
Yeah.
What do you think of the fact that Bowie won like five awards, Grammy awards, last night for this posthumous album compared to the one Grammy he'd won in his entire five-decade career? That's a little weird.
It's a little late, yeah.
Chance the Rapper's album Coloring Book did well. Best Rap Album, Best Performance. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. And Metallica and Lady Gaga performed together. Don't have audio of that. Don't have any audio of Fred Hatfield from Metallica singing because the mic cut out at the beginning. But I appreciate this because a lot of times they lip sync big events like this. And you understand why when things like this happen.
Yeah.
But hey, I respect that. They're actually up there performing, technical glitches and all.
It's live, and live is live. Let's go to a call now. We have Liz from Heartland. Hi, Liz.
Hello. I just wanted to say the best thing of the evening, I thought, was Bruno Mars' tribute to Prince. He just nailed it.
Why do you think he nailed it, Liz?
Well, I've been a big Prince fan forever, and the guitar solo at the end, I mean, was unbelievable, and the dancing, and it was just awesome, I thought.
A proper tribute.
Correct.
Well, thanks so much for your call.
Yeah, and that, I didn't see that one live. I've got to go back. I watched Bruno Mars' live performance as himself, but I have to go back and check out the Prince tribute. That seems like Morris Day and the Time, and then Bruno Mars joining in the Prince role. So I respect that. That's a good call. Let's go to another caller now. Chuck and Eagle River is with us. Chuck, hi.
Hey, guys. Love the show. Just wanted to recommend the new Sturgill Simpson album. He was nominated for Album of the Year. I think he won the Best Country Album. Mm-hmm. Very unique contrast. Not only that, he writes his own material, which is not always the case with these things. So I just wanted to say check him out and give him a try, even if you don't like the traditional country music, very unique feel to it with a horn section, all that. So I'll take my comment off the air.
Well, hold on, Chuck. He performed there, right, with the horn section from the Dap Kings, another kind of tribute because Sharon Jones of Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings passed away this year. What did you think of the that live combo performance?
Great. He's a very intense performer, kind of like a you know, he gives you those roots of Johnny Cash, a little flash of that kind of, you know, real, true country music. So, yeah, he's great.
Thank you so much for calling at 800-642-1234.
We have to give a nod to Beyonce as well, who did a very high-tech performance, and she was really decked out.
Uh-huh.
I saw in the pictures afterwards, she had a lot of garb on her head, and, you know, carrying twins, that's pretty remarkable. Let's take a listen.
Am I not thirsty enough? I don't care about the lights or the beams.
And this was, I did see this, especially in the build-up to it. I mean, there was some high-tech computer screen stuff going on there, and I couldn't, wait, is that the real Beyonce? No, that's a, there was a lot of CGI and wackiness going on there, and then she was out there for real, of course.
Yeah, good for her, though, to get out there and perform.
And she was very pregnant.
Yeah.
No doubt about that. I'll take one more caller. Abby is with us in Monroe. Abby, hi.
Hi. I'm glad that you're talking about Beyonce. My question is, what really makes an album of the year? Because you have Adele, who is a fantastic performer, but 25 was more along the lines of stuff that she's really done before, and it's a very typical Adele album. And Beyonce's Lemonade was so totally different than the side of Beyonce that we've seen, like Adele had mentioned in her acceptance speech. So there's kind of the question between, like, really, what makes an album of the year?
Interesting, Abby. Thanks. And you are not alone in exactly that line of thought. Adele herself, a lot of people thought Beyonce should have won that. Hey, you can keep sharing your thoughts. Thanks for your calls. If you didn't get in, you can post your thoughts on the Grammys on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Are girls taking over the world? Girls are said to outperform boys on exams. They're more likely to start and finish college. A pair of researchers in Canada interviewed 57 of these so-called super girls to find out what their lives are like as they strive for straight A's. And do they think they still need a leg up in a male-dominated world?
Shauna Pomerantz joins us. She's an associate professor of child and youth studies at Brock University in Ontario, Canada. She co-authored the new book, Smart Girls, Success, School, and the Myth of Post-Feminism. Shauna, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
You spent a lot of time with these smart girls. What are they like? Who are they?
Well, they come from all different walks of life. They are most certainly working very, very hard. One of the things we learned about these smart girls is that they are not afraid to call themselves smart, at least to researchers, but out there in school, they're a little bit more protective about their smart identity. So they engage in all sorts of negotiation tactics to kind of downplay their intelligence in order to get along in the schools.
How hard are they working?
They're working so hard that some of them talked about not really getting much sleep at night, sacrificing social lives. Girls were very, very concerned to do well, but they were also concerned that they had to do well at multiple things. So it wasn't just that they were smart. This Supergirl drive for success that we talk about in one of the chapters points to this idea that they had to be well-rounded. You know, they had to do well in extracurricular activities. They had to be part of school politics. They had to be fit, and they had to be also, you know, well-dressed and well-mannered.
What are the trade-offs for these girls? What are they sacrificing to maintain this extreme form of perfection in their lives?
Well, the girls we talked to weren't always into perfection, but there were certainly a small group of them who were very invested in doing everything well, the girls I just spoke about, who might fit this so-called Supergirl stereotype. But one of the things we really found is that the girls were not so much sacrificing as they were struggling in ways that seemed to be made invisible by very, very dominant media accounts of how well girls are doing today. So we talk about girls doing very well, now we need to pay attention to boys. But at the same time, we learned that girls are struggling with sexism, they're struggling with racism, they're struggling to maintain some of that perfection that I talked about. And so the book is really about trying to spotlight all the ways that girls are still struggling in spite of this idea that girls are doing very, very well in school.
Some of the adjectives that came up a lot, I found in your book, describe these smart girls in this way: ambitious, confident, optimistic. I read about passionate, thoroughly dedicated to school. What could possibly be going wrong here?
I know, it's a great question. And I think the media headlines today, and we've been seeing this for about 20 years now, suggest that girls are just fine. And now we really should be turning our attention to boys. And this has been a very, very popular discussion around gender and education easily since the early 90s. What's going wrong, I think, is that girls have left the agenda. They're no longer being focused on in the way they used to be in the 70s and 80s when feminists were working to kind of bring girls up to par with boys in the education system. And now girls are struggling to maintain not just perfection and not just high grades, but they're also struggling to sort out what's happening to them when they are being faced with sexism in the school, when a teacher is treating girls and boys differently, or when the boys in the school are talking to them about making them sandwiches, when the girls feel that they have to dumb down in order to be seen as hot or dateable or desirable by the boys. And so when I say stuff is happening, it's all very much below the surface of these bright futures and these straight A's that the girls are achieving.
We're talking with Shauna Pomerantz. She's the a co-author of the new book, Smart Girls, Success, School, and the Myth of Post-Feminism. Shauna, you interviewed 17 boys who identified themselves as being smart. How has the success of boys changed with the rise of these girls who are really keyed in on academic performance?
Mm-hmm. Well, boys have always done well and girls have always done well. It's not that boys do well at one time and then girls do well at the other times. Some boys do great, some girls do great. The problem is that we tend to talk about it in these very stark binary terms, boys versus girls. We don't usually bring in issues of race or class, which really complicate the picture of academic success. So when I say boys do great, I can say that middle-class white boys tend to do better than working-class black boys, for example, or other configurations that might really impact that. So I think that boys and girls, you know, sort of struggle along, but in very different ways. Boys tend to use humor. They tend to engage in class clown sort of personas in order to downplay their academic success so that they can still be popular in school. But the girls talked about dumbing down in a way that boys never, ever did. The boys simply didn't feel that they had to hide being smart, but they did feel that they had to downplay studying, whereas the girls felt that they sometimes had to downplay actually being intelligent.
A new report just came out in the journal Science. It's found that girls as young as age 6 perceive themselves to be less smart than boys. Are we a lot further away from gender equity than we think?
We sure are. That's certainly one of the things that we discovered in our own research. And I know that study, it's a very good study because it suggests that we might be thinking of girls as having reached gender equity, and we certainly talk that way. In the book, we frame it as a post-feminist narrative where we tend to think of girls as past the need for any attention at all. But when you read that study in Science, you realize that actually girls as young as 6 or younger are thinking of themselves as lesser than boys and men and as not being able to achieve the kind of success that boys and men achieve. And that's what we found in our study as well. Girls were working very, very hard, but they also felt that they had to work even harder than boys did to achieve a similar kind of success. So it wasn't so much disheartening as it was enlightening to see that we really do need to refocus our attention in education. We're not anywhere near as far as we thought on gender equity.
Where do we see these notions at such a young age coming from? I mean, where are these young girls getting this idea that they're not on par with their boy counterparts?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. I suppose we could point to media, as people do, and we could say that in popular culture we get representations of girls and boys doing really different things. You know, boys tend to be active in cartoons, in movies geared toward children, They tend to be superheroes. They tend to fight. They tend to solve problems. They tend to build. Whereas girls are seen much more socially. They tend to communicate and relate. They're seen more in the sphere of friendship and family as opposed to in that active world and in the outside world, too. And so I think that's one place we can look. But, you know, it's such a pervasive issue, and that study really put a spotlight on the fact that perhaps we're not doing as good a job as we think in the school system talking to boys and girls in similar ways. We do tend to see girls as pretty and cute, and we do tend to see boys as tough and rugged and sort of ingenious and industrious. And so those words alone set up the entire discussion about how young people see themselves.
When you interviewed over quite a while these 57 teenagers, most of them teenagers, mm-hmm. you broke down their situations by race, by home life, by their socioeconomic background. How do all of these different things factor into the formula for a smart girl?
Mm-hmm. Well, race was particularly interesting. The girls we interviewed in the Canadian context spoke a great deal about the smart Asian stereotype, which I know is prevalent in the United States as well. And it's the idea that Asian girls are simply smart by definition of their race. And so we talked to girls from various Asian cultures and backgrounds, and they had these really very, you know, interesting stories to tell about the fact that they're just not good at math and that everyone assumed that they would be. And when it turned out that they couldn't do homework for their friends, they became very disappointing, you know, sort of a traitor in a number of senses. And so race was salient because sometimes we think of certain races as being smarter than other races, and sometimes we think of certain races as being, you know, less smart. And around the issue of class, what we found is that the girls who really were able to achieve the highest level of that supergirl perfection I talked about earlier did tend to come from, although not always, but they tended to come from middle-class or upper-middle-class backgrounds with professional parents who really had the time and skills to devote to not just talking to them about the meaning of education, but getting them the help that they need vis-a-vis tutoring or, you know, extracurricular activities. All of those things cost money. And so a number of girls in the study who came from working class or working poor backgrounds, they felt that they had to work just a little bit harder to get that edge that middle class girls had.
We're talking about the rise of the smart girl, the rise of the super girl, and how girls negotiate this drive for academic success and what it means for boys. Shauna Pomerantz is with us. Her new book is Smart Girls, Success, School, and the Myth of Post-Feminism.
We'd like to hear your thoughts and maybe your experiences looking at how girls are doing at 800-642-1234. Is it cool at school for girls to be smart? Have girls reached gender parity with boys in academics from grade school on through college? Are boys being left behind? If you've been through school as a smart girl yourself, what was it like? Did you have to hide that you were smart? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post your thoughts and questions on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about supergirls, the teenage girls who strive for perfection in their schoolwork, and what happens when it transfers over into the rest of their lives. Girls are entering college and graduating at a higher rate than boys, but is this success coming with a cost?
We want to hear from girls on this as well at 800-642-1234. Are girls putting too much pressure on themselves to get ahead? Do you think we've achieved gender parity? And what about the boys in the classroom? Do you think it's now boys who are being left behind? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation with Youth Studies Professor Shauna Pomerantz. She's co-author of the new book, Smart Girls, Success, School, and the Myth of Post-Feminism.
Shauna, you asked the teenage girls about feminism and what it means to them. What did they tell you about feminism?
Oh, well, they had a lot of different things to say, but I would say overall they were somewhat distancing from the idea of being feminist. What we found so interesting is that the girls all say very feminist things. You know, they don't want to be put down by boys. They don't want to be objectified. They don't want to be taken for granted. And they aspire to such great success in their careers. But at the same time, if you ask them, are you a feminist or do you believe that feminist politics are necessary, they will often say, no, they're not feminist. And so we struggled sometimes in interviews to help them possibly see that they were, in fact, engaging with feminism without even really knowing that they were doing it.
What does this post-feminist world then look like?
Well, the culture is post-feminist, but I don't know that all girls are. I mean, the culture is post-feminist because in media and popular culture representations in the news, there's endless stories that suggest that girls are equal to boys, that girls are even superior to boys, and that's what this discourse in education is all about. Not only are girls seen as doing just as well as boys, but now they're seen as doing better, leaving boys in the dust. And so part of the book is about explaining that, well, that may be what it looks like on paper, it's not really what it looks like in practice. We analyze some statistics of CEOs and government and, you know, various institutions, and we find that men still hold the power in the majority of those situations. So while girls may be doing well in school, they're not necessarily rising up and, you know, taking the power that people think they're taking in the broader world.
Let's take a call now with Jane from Oconto. Hi, Jane.
Yes. I think my daughter would qualify as one of those super girls. She can't call right now because she's working as a physician's assistant. She also volunteers one afternoon a week, and she's carrying a full load in the honors track at Drake. And her first semester, she made Dean's List. She's been on the president's list ever since. And I think she would say that it is not helpful to constantly be comparing. The point is to encourage everyone to treat people as individuals, acknowledge their efforts and their work without.
Jane, did she have this drive from a very young age? When did you see this in her?
Well, she had a 4.0 in high school. She has a very good older siblings. She has a sister who's working on her doctorate in psychology, a brother who's graduating with a master's in music, and she is probably the most driven and the most organized of the three.
Shauna?
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like she comes from a very high-achieving family. Would you say that's the case, Jane?
I think so. They all know that they have to work hard to get where they want to be. And I think when students and people start seeing each other as colleagues without the dismissive gender labels, I think they get further. I think you're right that they're still high-achieving women often are not taken as seriously as their male counterparts, but I don't think saying, oh, boys have been preferred, now girls should be preferred, boys should be preferred, isn't helping the matters any.
It's not helping at all. As a matter of fact, one of the main points of the book is to really move outside of that really narrow discussion. We kind of chronicle the boys versus girls debate, and as I said, it's been going on easily for 20 years now in both the United States, Canada, and overseas too, in the UK, Australia, New Zealand. We have similar, you know, common sense thinking. So one of the main points of the book isn't to put girls ahead of boys or to show how girls are suffering more than boys, but really to suggest that the idea of gender as this divisive category is not useful. Girls are struggling in ways that are made invisible by these very, very stark categorizations. We'd like to make visible the struggles of all kids. And so we happen to focus on girls in the book because there seems to be a particular bent right now towards suggesting that girls are just fine, as I said, this post-feminist culture. And we wanted to expose that as an absolute myth. We're not in a post-feminist world. Girls need feminism now just as much, if not more, than they ever have. And so, Jane, I agree with you that these dismissive gender labels are not useful.
Jane, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Jessica in New Berlin. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
What would you like to add?
I guess I would like to add that I didn't feel the need to dumb myself down when I was in grade school or high school or college, but I did see that in my peers. I didn't see it in my, like, I went to a very, very small school, so I had, like, 8 kids in my class, and I had other very smart girls around me, so it was very cool to be smart in my class, but I did see it with the girls that I had extracurricular activities with. They went to public school, and they had to, it seemed like it wasn't as cool to be smart where they went to school.
Shauna?
Jessica, first of all, thanks for calling. It's great to get some firsthand experience. One of the things we found in our research, and we've written about this in the book, is that the school the girls went to really, really made a difference. So it sounds like you went to a school where it was cool to be smart, you know, 8 kids in the class. I'm sure academic success was considered really important and a huge part of school culture. But there are other schools, and we talked to girls from about 15 different schools across Ontario. Other schools didn't have a cool to be smart attitude. In fact, it was just the opposite. It was more of a cheerleading culture. Girls felt that they had to balance their academic success with being, you know, hot, thin, pretty. And so I suppose it really depends on the school you go to. One of the things we talk about at the end of the book is that a school culture really makes or breaks how a girl feels about her academic success. And so I think you are very lucky to have gone to a school where that was considered a cool thing to be.
And, Shauna, you conclude in your book that it is cool to be a smart girl, just like Jessica made her comment about it was cool to be a girl in her class. But what is the alternative? Girls who want to live a fulfilling life have really no choice but to really go after it, and succeed.
Yes, I mean, the alternative is not as glamorous or as successful. You either go for it or you don't. But we didn't talk to girls who didn't call themselves smart, but our feeling is that there's a large group of girls out there being ignored because, of course, they're not doing as well as some of the more talked-about girls are doing. And those girls need attention, too. We don't want girls falling through the cracks. We don't want boys falling through the cracks. So I wouldn't say that all girls felt that they had to succeed. I would say some girls felt more driven than others. Some girls had the home life privilege and the class-based privilege to really get that edge, as I mentioned earlier. And other girls were really in the middle. You know, they were just kind of getting along and getting sort of C's and B's. Not every girl gets straight A's, which is contrary to what is sort of the popular discussion out there today.
Thank you, Jessica, for your call. Let's now go to Brittany in Madison. Hi, Brittany.
Hello.
What would you like to add?
I just wanted to add that I was a smart girl. Still am, but I got severely bullied because of it. I didn't have friends for a lot of years, and there's a lot of things in life I could have learned, you know, if I didn't have that. I think the socioeconomic differences in schools is very prevalent. I moved from a not-so-good school outside of Detroit to a really very nice school in New Berlin and was able to become much more successful than I would have.
I'm going to have to jump in here. Shauna, very quickly, what about the situation with Brittany being bullied for being a smart girl?
Not uncommon, Brittany, and thanks for sharing your story. We heard from girls that they were sometimes teased. We didn't hear extreme cases of bullying, but this is why girls felt the need to dumb down. They just didn't always feel that it meshed with being either cool or popular or even just accepted at school.
Shauna, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Shauna Pomerantz, co-author of the book Smart Girls, Success, School, and the Myth of Post-Feminism. She joined us to talk about her research on how girls deal with academic superiority and what barriers they still face today. You can add your comments on the Central Time Facebook page.
Legendary jazz singer Al Jarreau passed away yesterday at age 76.
Jarreau was born and raised in Milwaukee, and he was a graduate of Ripon College. He went on to win 6 Grammy Awards through his career, along with a bunch of other nominations.
Frequent Central Time guest Piet Levy at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel writes that Jarreau never lost his connection with Milwaukee. A bandmate says that the singer would say, "I'm from Milwaukee," at some point during almost every performance. Some of Jarreau's first paid performances were at the Pfister Hotel in Milwaukee.
Last year, he wrote an opinion piece in the Journal Sentinel calling for more investment in Milwaukee's kids, and especially in art and music education, and his farewell wish he called on people to help children in his hometown instead of sending flowers and gifts.
You can read more about Al Jarreau and his Milwaukee connection in Piet Levy's article. We have that linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
In the morning, there's bluebirds singing a love song. Nothing but bluebirds from now on. I never saw the sun shining so bright. Never saw things going so right. Noticing the day.